Chapter 3. Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder and the Cost of Killing in Vietnam. PTSD. The Legacy of Vietnam. Before a presentation to the leadership of New York's Jewish war veterans, in a grand old hotel up in the Catskills, over a bowl of borscht, I met Claire, a woman who knew the meaning of PTSD. She had been a nurse in Burma during World War II and had seen more human suffering than any person should. It had never really bothered her, but when the Gulf War started, she began to have nightmares. Nightmares of an endless stream of torn and mangled bodies. She was suffering from PTSD, a mild case, but PTSD nonetheless. After another presentation in New York, a veteran's wife asked me to talk with her and her husband. At Anzio, he had won the Distinguished Service Cross, our nation's second highest award for valor, and he continued to fight throughout World War II. 5 years ago, he retired. Now, all he will do is sit around the house and watch war movies. And he is obsessed with the fact that he is a coward. He is suffering from PTSD. Post-traumatic stress disorder has always been with us, but the long delay time and the erratic nature of its occurrence has made us like the ancient Celts who did not understand the link between sex and pregnancy. What is PTSD? Quote, Vietnam was an American nightmare that hasn't yet ended for the veterans of that war. In the rush to forget the debacle that became our longest war, America found it necessary to conjure up a scapegoat and transferred the heavy burden of blame onto the shoulders of the Vietnam veteran. It's been a crushing weight for them to carry. Rejected by the nation that sent them off to war, the veterans have been plagued with guilt and resentment, which has created an identity crisis unknown to veterans of previous wars. D. Andrade. Post-traumatic stress disorder is described by the American Psychological Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders as a reaction to a psychologically traumatic event outside the range of normal experience. Manifestations of PTSD include recurrent and intrusive dreams and recollections of the experience, emotional blunting, social withdrawal, exceptional difficulty or reluctance in initiating or maintaining intimate relationships, and sleep disturbances. These symptoms can in turn lead to serious difficulties in readjusting to civilian life, resulting in alcoholism, divorce, and unemployment. The symptoms persist for months or years after the trauma, often emerging after a long delay. Estimates of the number of Vietnam veterans suffering from PTSD range from the disabled American veterans figure of 500,000 to Harris and Associates' 1980 estimate of 1.5 million, or somewhere between 18% and 54% of the 2.8 million military personnel who served in Vietnam. How does PTSD relate to killing? Quote, societies which ask men to fight on their behalf should be aware of what the consequences of their actions may so easily be. Richard Holmes, Acts of War. In 1988, a major study by Jeannie and Stephen Stellman at Columbia University examined the relationship between PTSD manifestations and a soldier's involvement in the killing process. This study of 6,810 randomly selected veterans is the first in which combat levels have been quantified. Stellman and Stellman found that the victims of PTSD were almost solely veterans who participated in high-intensity combat situations. These veterans suffer far higher incidence of divorce, marital problems, tranquilizer use, alcoholism, joblessness, heart disease, high blood pressure, and ulcers. As far as PTSD symptoms are concerned, soldiers who were in non-combat situations in Vietnam were found to be statistically indistinguishable from those who spent their entire enlistment in the United States. During the Vietnam era, millions of American adolescents were drafted and conditioned to engage in an act against which they had a powerful resistance. This conditioning is a necessary part of allowing a soldier to succeed and survive in the environment where society has placed him. Success in war and national survival may necessitate killing enemy soldiers in battle. If we accept that we need an army, then we must accept that it has to be as capable of surviving as we can make it. But if society prepares a soldier to overcome his resistance to killing, and places him in an environment in which he will kill, then that society has an obligation to deal forthrightly, intelligently, and morally with the result and its repercussions upon the soldier and the society, largely through an ignorance of the processes and implications involved. This has not happened with the Vietnam veteran. PTSD and non-killers, accessory to murder. After I had presented the essence of the hypotheses of this book to the leadership of a state Vietnam Veterans Coalition, one of the vets said to me, "Your premise, the trauma of killing enabled by conditioning and amplified by society's homecoming, is valid not only for those who killed, but for those who supported the killing." This was the state's Veteran of the Year, a lawyer named Dave, who was an articulate, dynamic leader within the organization. The truck driver who drove the ammo up, he explained, also drove dead bodies back. There is no definitive distinction between the guy pulling the trigger and the guy who supported him in Vietnam. And, said another veteran, almost whispering, society didn't make any distinction in who they spat on. And, continued Dave, just like if you came in this room and attacked one of us, you would be attacking all of us. Society, this nation, attacked every one of us. His point is valid. Everyone in that room understood that he was not talking about the veterans of non-combat situations in Vietnam who, according to Stellman and Stellman, were found to be statistically indistinguishable from those who spent their entire enlistment in the United States. Dave was referring to the veterans who participated in high-intensity combat situations. They may not have killed, but they were there in the midst of the killing, and they were confronted daily with the results of their contribution to the war. In study after study, two factors show up again and again as critical to the magnitude of the post-traumatic stress response. First and most obvious is the intensity of the initial trauma. The second and less obvious, but absolutely vital factor, is the nature of the social support structure available to the traumatized individual. In rapes, we have come to understand the magnitude of the trauma inflicted upon the victim by the defense tactic of accusing the victim during trials, and have taken legal steps to prevent and constrain such attacks upon the victim by a defendant's attorneys. In combat, the relationship between the nature of the trauma and the nature of the social support structure is the same. PTSD and the World War II veteran. The degree of trauma and the degree of social support work together to amplify each other in a kind of multiplicative relationship. For instance, let us take two hypothetical World War II veterans. One of them was a 23-year-old infantryman who saw extensive combat, killed enemy soldiers at close range, and held his buddy in his arms as he died from close-range enemy small arms fire. The trauma he endured would probably rate at the very top of the degree of trauma scale. Our other World War II veteran was a 25-year-old truck driver. He might just as easily have been an artilleryman, an airplane mechanic, or a bosun's mate on a Navy supply ship, who served honorably, but never really got up in the front lines. Although he was in an area that took some incoming artillery, or bombing or torpedoes on a few occasions, he never was even in a situation where it was expected that he would have to shoot at anyone, and no one ever really shot at him. But he did have someone he knew killed by the artillery fire or bombs or torpedoes, and he did see the constant remains of death and carnage as he moved along behind the advancing Allied lines. He would be placed very low on our degree of trauma scale. When our hypothetical World War II veterans came home after the war, they returned as a unit together with the same guys they had spent the whole war with, on board a ship, spending weeks joking, laughing, gambling, and telling tall tales as they cooled down and depressurized in what psychologists would call a very supportive group therapy environment on the long voyage home. And if they had doubts about what they'd done or fears about the future, they had a sympathetic group to talk to. Jim Goodwin notes in his book how resort hotels were taken over and made into redistribution stations, to which these veterans brought their wives and devoted 2 weeks to reacquainting themselves with their family on the best possible terms, in an environment in which they were still surrounded by the company of their fellow veterans. Goodwin also observes that the civilian population they were returning to had been prepared to help and understand the returning veteran through movies such as The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, The Best Years of Our Lives, and pride of the Marines. They were victorious. They were justifiably proud of themselves, and their nation was proud of them and let them know it. Our infantryman was one of the comparatively few World War II veterans who participated in a ticker tape parade in New York. Everyone griped about how what they really wanted to do was to put all this Army BS behind him, but he would privately admit that marching in front of those tens of thousands of cheering civilians was one of the high points of his life. And today, even just the remembrance of it tends to make his chest swell a little with pride. Our truck driver, like the majority of returning vets, did not participate in a ticker tape parade, but he would probably say that it made him feel good to know that vets were being honored. And next Memorial Day, he did march in his hometown parade as part of the American Legion's commemoration ceremonies. No one was making him do it, but he did it anyway because, well, damn it, because he felt like it. And he would keep on doing it every year, just like the World War I vets in his town had done as he was growing up. Both our veterans generally stayed in touch with their World War II buddies, and they'd linked up with their old comrades in reunions and informal get-togethers, and that was nice. But what was really best about being a veteran was being able to hold their heads high and knowing just how much your family, friends, community, and nation respected you and were proud of you. The GI Bill was passed, and if some politician or bureaucrat or organization didn't give the vets the respect they deserved, well, buddy, they would have to answer to the influence and votes of the American Legion and the VFW, who would make damn sure you got treated right. On our scale, the social support network to these two veterans can be rated as high. Not all returning World War II vets got this kind of support, and it was no bed of roses to return from combat under the best of circumstances, but their nation generally did the best for them that it could. Remember that the relationship between the degree of trauma scale and the social support scale is multiplicative. These two factors amplify each other. For our infantryman, that means that his highly traumatic experience was largely, but perhaps not completely, negated by the very supportive social structure he returned to. Our truck driver, suffering very little trauma and having received a great deal of support, will probably be able to deal with his combat experiences. Our infantryman may tend to medicate himself pretty regularly down at the bar at the American Legion, but like most veterans, he will probably continue to function and lead a perfectly healthy life. PTSD and the Vietnam veteran. Now let us consider two hypothetical Vietnam veterans, an 18-year-old infantryman and a 19-year-old truck driver. The infantryman arrived at the combat zone, like most every other soldier in Vietnam, as an individual replacement who didn't know a soul in his unit. Eventually, he engaged in extensive close combat. He killed several enemy soldiers, but the hard part was that they were wearing civilian clothes, and one of them, well, damn, he was just a kid. Couldn't have been more than 12. And he had his best buddy die in his arms during a firefight. The trauma he endured definitely rates at the top end of the scale. Maybe fighting kids in civilian uniforms, with no rear lines and no chance to ever really rest and get away from the battle, maybe that makes the trauma he endured greater than that of our World War II vet. But at the top of the trauma scale, there probably isn't much value in trying to distinguish between shades of black. The truck driver also arrived home, but although his job was the same as the World War II truck driver, the environment in which he had to do it had changed. There was no rear area for him. He could never really let his guard down, even when you were off duty, and convoys were one long hell of fear from ambushes and mines. It was like living in the Battle of the Bulls all the time. Convoys into base camps were often like some kind of relief of Bastogne, and his truck was always armored and sandbagged in a way that a World War II truck driver would probably never even have considered doing. Fortunately, he never did have to shoot at anybody, but that was always a possibility. And he kept his weapon handy and loaded all the time, and plenty of people were shooting in his general direction on several occasions. Our Vietnam-era truck driver might rate low on the trauma scale, slightly higher than that of his counterpart in World War II, but not unmanageably so. Our two Vietnam veterans departed the war the way they had arrived, alone. They departed with a mixture of joy at having survived and shame at having left their buddies behind. Instead of returning to parades, they found anti-war marches. Instead of luxury hotels, they were sent to locked and guarded military bases, where they were processed back to civilian life in a few days. Instead of movies about the veteran, his struggles, and his vulnerable emotional state upon re-entry into civilian life, the media prepared the American people by calling the returning veterans depraved fiends and psychopathic killers, and beautiful young movie stars led the accusing chant of a nation that echoed through the veteran's soul, baby killers, murderers, butchers. They were rejected by girlfriends, spit on, and accused by strangers, and dared not even admit to close friends that they were veterans. They did not show up for Memorial Day parades, which had gone out of style. They did not join the VFW or the American Legion. And they did not participate in any reunions or get-togethers with old comrades. They denied their experiences and buried their pain and grieving beneath a shell. Some Vietnam vets had families and communities that could insulate them from this, but the vast majority had only to turn on the TV to find themselves being attacked. Even the most average of Vietnam vets endured an absolutely unprecedented degree of societal condemnation. On our social support scale, our two Vietnam veterans rated at the condemn end of the scale. Remember the multiplicative, amplifying relationship between trauma and social support. For our truck driver, the interaction between his limited combat trauma in Vietnam and the societal condemnation that he endured afterward resulted in a total experience that might very well have been more conducive to post-traumatic stress than that experienced by a veteran of close combat in World War II. For our infantry veteran of Vietnam, the magnitude of the total trauma experience is beyond description. The diffusion of responsibility that happens in combat is a two-way street. It absolves a killer of a part of his guilt, diffusing it to the leaders who gave the order and the truck driver who brought the ammo and hauled back the bodies. But it does so by giving a piece of the killer's guilt to others, and those others must then deal with it just as surely as must the killer. If these accessories to killing in combat are accused and condemned, then their slice of the trauma, guilt, and responsibility is amplified, and it will reverberate in their souls as shock and horror. The Vietnam vet, the average vet who did no killing, is suffering an agony of guilt and torment created by society's condemnation. During and immediately after Vietnam, our society judged and condemned millions of returning veterans as accessories to murder. At one level, many, even most, of these horrified, confused veterans accepted society's media-driven kangaroo court conviction as justice and locked themselves in prisons of the worst kind, prisons in their mind, a prison whose name is PTSD. I have known these men, both our hypothetical World War II vets and our two Vietnam vets. They are not hypothetical at all. They are real. Their pain is real. Societies that ask men to fight on their behalf should be aware of what the consequences and what the price of their actions may so easily be.